When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode of Into the Night was made possible by the unwavering support of our dedicated Patreon donors. Their generosity allows us to delve deeper into the mysteries that await us in the dark world of Five Nights at Freddy's. If you're captivated by the secrets we unveil and wish to be part of our journey, we invite you to explore our Patreon page. By becoming a patron, you not only gain exclusive access to bonus content, behind-the-scenes insights, and special perks, but you also play a vital role in sustaining the future of this podcast. Visit the link provided in the description below to learn more and join the Night Conclave. Hello, and welcome to Into the Night, a Five Nights at Freddy's podcast. I am your host, Nick, and thank you for listening. Well, here we are again. It's always such a pleasure. I still remember the last two reviews I have done on this podcast, and how Steelwool disappointed me twice. The 10-year anniversary of FNAF was underway last week, and the celebration was nothing short of momentous. We were treated to new game releases, captivating demos, updates on forthcoming projects, and even an exclusive interview with the mastermind behind the franchise and the madness, Scott Cawthon.
Security breach, there's a really big story behind that. That was definitely a challenging period, and a lot of things just didn't align up perfectly for that. And there were a lot of reasons for that.
But let's set that aside for now. The pinnacle of festivities occurred the day before the anniversary, with their early release of Megacat Studios' debut entry into the FNAF universe, a video game adaptation of Fazbear Fright's inaugural and eponymous chapter, Into the Pit.
A surprise, to be sure, but a welcome one.
Without delving too deeply into it, let's provide a brief overview for those who might not be as immersed in the series day in and day out as I am. Here's a summary of the anniversary celebrations and what you might have missed last week. On August 1st, Kane Carter and the Pop Goes team unveiled a new official entry in the Fazbear Fanverse initiative, My Pop Goes. If you follow us on YouTube, you might have even caught us streaming the game live, experiencing it with blind eyes. The game is quite enchanting, striking a delicate balance between the cheerful aesthetics reminiscent of a Tamagotchi clone and a more insidious undertone that hints at something darker lurking just beneath the surface, though never fully exposing itself. The visuals are the standout feature of the game, drawing inspiration from the classic Tiger electronic games of the 1980s, with their simplistic controls and a remarkable recreation of the printed-on graphics that just add a nice level of nostalgic charm to it. The collectibles add an extra layer of engagement, offering incentives to check out the game's challenge modes, notably the customization options and various items including different playable characters, alternate layouts, and my personal favorite, the extensive array of collectible stickers. Oh, it just enhances the overall experience. It's a pretty solid game for $5, and unlike a wide variety of, let's call them cloak and dagger horror games that have become popular over the last decade, such as Doki Doki Literature Club, Let's Find Larry, and even FNAF World to some degree, My Pop Goes excels at presenting itself as a straightforward, enjoyable, and seemingly innocent game. I seriously could give this game to my nephew, and not only would it not scar him, but his parents would also probably not pick up on the fact that this was a horror game, due to how contained and limited the disturbing imagery is. But I'd never do that. Maybe. Following the release of My Pop Goes, we were treated to a demo from Nixon for his long-anticipated project, The Joy of Creation Remastered. My close friend Benjamin, who plays a crucial role in assisting with the budgeting of my projects and is both a dedicated Freddy's fan and a loyal listener of Into the Night, aptly described The Joy of Creation as the most unofficial official FNAF game. This characterization doesn't imply that it surpasses Pop Goes or Candies in official merit, but rather that if we rewind to the early 2019s, before the debut of Help Wanted, The Joy of Creation was a closer approximation of what many in the fanbase envisioned as a modern high-caliber FNAF experience, a more accurate manifestation of our imagined, idealized version of a AAA Five Nights at Freddy's game, at least a closer approximation than Security Bleach. It's gonna be hard not to express let's just call it my opprobrium for Steel this episode, isn't it?
Correct!
But to stay on the positive notes, The Joy of Creation, if you haven't yet tried the demo, I'll provide a link to it along with my Pop Goes in the episode description. The demo is, of course, free and absolutely outstanding. It superbly captures the gritty, unsettling atmosphere of the original FNAF games, particularly those from the first four installments, with its environment steeped in perpetual, eerie decay. The Fazbear Band in particular appear more garish and unsettling than ever before, while the animations, especially those of the player character, they can be somewhat meme-worthy in their intensity. They do contribute a distinctive style, though, that heightens the tension, especially as the time to act dwindles. The game's mechanics, encompassing the environment, power system, animatronic and cameras, will feel familiar to fans of FNAF-style games, but have been modernized to suit both free-roam gameplay and the updated engine. And let's not overlook the most impressive aspect The Joy of Creation masterly evokes, those classic FNAF heebie-jeebies that we all cherish, while also introducing its own distinct approach to eliciting the goosebumps. The jump scare mechanics, in particular, are quite the sophisticated evolution of the tradition. While jump scares are a staple of the FNAF series, and their shock value has waned somewhat over time, except in a few titles like FNAF 4 where the tension still holds up, The Joy of Creation reinvigorates this element of the series. Instead of merely relying on the surprise of a monstrous assault, the game enhances the horror by focusing on the aftermath of an encounter. Each jump scare is accompanied by a unique stylized animation and sound design that highlights the terrifyingly uncanny manner in which the animatronic ends your life, adding a deeply unsettling touch to each game over screen, but also a memorable one. On August 3rd, Scholastic released a free ebook for Scott Cawthon's new interactive book project, VIP. I'm pleased we had the opportunity to explore this book to gain a clearer understanding of what it entails, as the preview descriptions were somewhat ambiguous regarding how we should set our expectations. Overall, the book offers a refreshing way to delve into the world of Freddy's. For fans of the Security Breach era in particular, it provides a unique chance to experience the glam rocks and the Pizzaplex during their prime, when everything was running as intended. As always, I'll include a link in the description. It's a brief read, so if you're interested, you can easily explore multiple endings in a single setting. On August 4th, we were graced with an interview featuring Scott Cawthon. It was truly a pleasure to hear from him once again and gain insights into his various projects, both past and present, but we'll talk about that though in a little bit. On the following day, August 5th, it brought the exciting announcement of a collaboration between Five Nights at Freddy's and Dead by Daylight.
Thank you!
While some fans have expressed disappointment that we didn't see a Fortnite crossover, and I can understand that sentiment, considering Scott's past collaborations and the backlash from the Roblox game incident, it's unlikely he'd wanted his characters involved in a shooter of all things, especially one where Freddy Fazbear might get 360 no-scoped from Travis Scott at Tilted Towers. Then we got a new trailer from Steelwolf for a brand new game, The Secrets of the Mimic, with the tagline, "To see the future, you have to understand the past," aka, we f***ed up this current plotline because we didn't put any effort in expositing any backstory or world building, so we have to pull a FNAF 4 stunt and have a new game clarify the plot so the story is finally digestible.
He said it!
Alright, I don't mean to be cynical, and vulgarity is an excuse for a lack of wit. I'm not cross, far from it. I'm actually rather vindicated to see that my suggestions back in the Mimic episode about going into the past to better articulate the current plotline seems to be the direction Scott is going for with the series. I'm just happy to see FNAF be brought back into a direction I think is better for its overall longevity and artistic health. Not to mention that the trailer hints that the game will be set in 1979, the oldest time period we've yet to explore in the universe, as well as an era that maintains an expected darker tone and environment that we've all grown to love and enjoy with the FNAF series. On August 7th, we saw the release of Five Laps at Freddy's. I'll take a balanced approach and state the obvious. While it's understandable that Scott might want to create a lighthearted mascot kart racing game for his franchise, I have reservations about its suitability for the series, especially given its potential price point. Unless it's presented in a manner akin to My Pop Goes or Pop Goes Arcade, whatever price point they decide on could be unjustified for the quality we are seeing. That's not to say the game can't indeed be enjoyable, but let's be honest, the demo reveals a product that currently appears fundamentally flawed and unlikely to appeal to anyone beyond the most dedicated FNAF fans. And I don't mean that in the same way as the movie was made for FNAF fans, I mean literally. The most dedicated FNAF fans will find enjoyment out of it. On that same day, due to some mismanagement of the Japanese release date, Into the Pit was made available to the public. And now, we find ourselves on the brink of another FNAF game. Some listeners have accused me of being overly cynical in my previous reviews of SteelWorld entries, while others have commended my neutral stance and candid critiques, appreciating my commitment to speaking honestly and openly about my feelings on the series. Where does Into the Pit fall into place? Did Megacat Studios do this series justice for its 10th year celebration? Or did it continue the precipice downfall of a series that may have gone too deep into the multimedia bear trap? I shall say this, with no uncertain terms or exaggeration, Into the Pit is one of the best FNAF games to ever be released. From the moment I saw the trailer, I knew this game was going to be something special, and I am more than happy to report and sing the game's praises from here to, well, pretty much just here. But finally, a FNAF game has fully returned me to the world I love and the memories that I cherish from them. Ironic, given how dark and bloody this world is, yet it still instills me with hope and optimism, how things are never the way they seem on the surface. Before I get all giddy, let's try and tackle this one by one. The story of Into the Pit closely follows the plot of the novella, though some adjustments have been made for gameplay purposes. The narrative centers on Oswald, a young teenager living in a dilapidated town plagued by economic hardship. With no friends and limited summer activities, Oswald's days are marked by monotony. On the final day of summer, his father, who has been working a part-time job at a gas station mini-mart to make ends meet, drops him off at Jeff's Pizza, as he has done throughout the season. True to form, Oswald's father is late picking him up from the rundown eatery. In retaliation, Oswald decides to hide inside the dusty Paul Pit in Jeff's Pizza, a place he has overheard others mention during the day. When Oswald plunges into the pit, he emerges to find the pizza joint transformed into a vibrant scene of boundless energy. Children in retro clothing play energetically. The walls and floors gleam with cleanliness pristine. In a trio, animatronics perform energetically on the stage, moving in sync with cheerful, bouncy music. Immersed in this surreal fantasy, Oswald momentarily sets aside his questions on reality and allows himself to enjoy the madness. However, the enchantment quickly turns to horror as the lights abruptly go out, plunging the restaurant into darkness and filling the air with screams of terror. When Oswald investigates, he discovers that several children have either been murdered or taken hostage by a monstrous yellow rabbit-like creature. Although it resembles an animatronic, similar to the other three middle animals on stage, which also begin to act erratically after the yellow rabbit's appearance, this creature has a raspy breath and a grotesque, fleshy mouth with a sinister, canine-filled grin. Panicked, Oswald rushes back to the pit and emerges in the present day, where his father is waiting for him. as his father reprimands him for his disobedience, the yellow rabbit suddenly erupts from the pit, dragging his father into it. The creature then seizes Oswald by the arm and pulls him back to his family home. Oswald then realizes that, while he still sees the yellow rabbit, everyone else perceives his father as normal, leaving him isolated in his horrifying experience. Now, Oswald must evade the wrath of the yellow rabbit and its menacing gaze, all while juggling his impending school schedule and the monster's perfect camouflage. To succeed, he needs to make trips back to the past, both to save the children who have yet to fall victim to the creature, and to rescue his father, who remains trapped somewhere in the pizzeria's past. Visually, the game embraces a 32-bit graphic style reminiscent of classic horror point-and-click adventures such as Clock Tower, with a similar tone to the Fatal Frame series if you're familiar with it. While the game shares similar visual aesthetics with these titles, it distinguishes itself with a unique survival horror experience. The focus of games like these is on the stealth, and adapting to a range of random events that require improvisation. However, Into the Pit places slightly more emphasis on the latter aspect, prioritizing the dynamic and unpredictable nature of the gameplay. From an animation perspective, the graphics are satisfactory and smooth for a retro-style game. Oswald, Pit Bonnie, and the environment all exhibit fluid and lifelike movement that brings them all to life despite the retro-style graphics. The 8-bit cutscenes are particularly impressive, showcasing an uncanniness and attention to detail. They suck you in with their visuals, but they also don't take up too much of your time. They also expertly capture the uncanny jerkiness of the animatronic characters in the FNAF universe, which is a huge plus. The game also expertly utilizes techniques to maximize the foreground as much as the mid and background, covering the screen with plastic balls as transition when going back in time through the ball pit, spiders crawling across the screen, and Pit Trap messing with the visuals when he feels like breaking the rules of reality when it suits him. Even the menu boasts a charming stylization featuring sketches of Oswald's past and present, alongside a diverse array of animatronic characters of his own design. The user interface is intuitive, clearly presenting your inventory, map, and quest markers. The most notable improvement I must commend is not only the narrative, something I deeply value in my FNAF projects, but also the atmosphere itself. It superbly recaptures the dark and unsettling unpredictability of the original Five Nights at Freddy's series, while at the same time infusing it with its own unique twist and flair. The pizzeria, particularly after Pit Bonnie has wreaked havoc, transforms into a treacherous and unpredictable hunting ground, and navigating this dangerous environment is both thrilling and highly enjoyable. The variety of hiding spots available to evade Pit Bonnie are designed with a sense of fragility, providing only a slim chance of security behind them. The accompanying hiding minigames intended to keep you concealed from Pit Bonnie are equally devious in their design. I'll delve further into this when we discuss the gameplay, where I have some additional thoughts to share, but they expertly heighten the tension whenever you hide from Pit Bonnie, as you're always aware that hiding does not guarantee safety. Perhaps the most surprising praise I can offer is for the game's sound design. Final Fantasy Freddy's has always been known for its strong sound design. Correction, particularly during its golden age was it known for its strong sound design. The masterful combination here, though, of ambient drones and echoes of mechanical footsteps that both inspire dread and alert of upcoming dangers is masterful. It's a fantastic dance between communicating danger for you to prepare yourself for and concealing the threats with red herrings to muddy the water. Pit Bonnie, in particular, is a masterful symphony of monstrous noises and robotic groans that convey its otherworldly nature. It transcends the mere concept of a robot or a person in a costume. It feels like a demon disguised as both. Its raspy moans while searching for you, and its garbled speech when taunting you are designed to unsettle, evoking a sense of dread and discomfort that keeps you on edge and makes your teeth grit in revulsion. On topic of the gameplay, I do want to address my criticisms quickly because, from a narrative, atmospheric, and visual standpoint, I have only praise for the game. Although there is a minor issue I have with the visuals, the game over screen looks kind of half-assed. in all honesty. In fact, the main menu as a whole seems oddly lower in quality compared to the rest of the game. I'm not sure why this discrepancy exists, but the quasi-realistic style of the still images for Pit Bonnie feels surprisingly cheap when contrasted with the detailed sketchbook design of the menu and the UI, as well as the retro aesthetics of the game playing cutscenes while in-game. I can see where they're going with it. It's trying to evoke memories of the original FNAF games, what with the twitching animatronic heads, but I don't know, it just doesn't look too good here in my opinion. Regarding the gameplay, my primary critique focuses on Pit Bonnie's hiding mechanic. Throughout most of the game, you'll be engaged in evading and outmaneuvering Pit Bonnie, using distractions to divert him, your flashlight to momentarily stun him, and maintaining the security of your hiding spots as he investigates your location. It is in this latter aspect that I have a significant issue with Into the Pit's gameplay loop. As common with minigames, the primary challenge developers face often revolves around game theory. No, not the channel, but the principle. When a player discovers the most optimal solution to a problem, they will invariably use it every time. For those who did watch our day one stream on our YouTube channel, Flat Cap Podcast Productions, you'll recall that in the later part of the stream, I repeatedly relied on a specific hiding spot whenever Pit Bonnie discovered me. The vents. In a game of uncertainty, the vents may offer the most consistent guarantee of safety in the entire game. You get four massive benefits when you use a vent. 1. The vents are a hiding spot that you can use to hide from Pit Bonnie. 2. The hiding minigame associated with the vents is notably easier and more consistent to succeed in. Each hiding spot in the game has a unique minigame attached to it. Golden Freddy's suit, or some cabinets require you to hold your breath when Pit Bonnie gets near and regain enough air before he comes back. Some require you to hide from his sight when he investigates further. And some, like underneath the tables or the beds, is just a simple coin toss on whether or not he does check beneath them, and if you remember to replace your flashlight battery to stun him in time. The vents provide, perhaps, the most dependable of all the minigames, where you simply need to swat spiders using the ASDF keys. You only use each key once, and you have ample time to clear the spider before Pit Bonnie becomes alerted. Simply put, the hiding spot just doesn't offer the same level of demand as the others do. It's just so consistent to win it. 3. The vents also act as fast travel points across the pizzeria. When you're trying to avoid the presence of Pit Bonnie for most of the game, being able to travel multiple rooms in a matter of seconds adds up a lot. And 4, and this one is the biggest, every single vent location also has a distraction mechanic literally in the same room. If you need to really make sure Bonnie isn't going to be where you are, you have literally no reason not to sound an alarm and get him to drag himself across the map while you can fast travel to the other side immediately and ultimately have a near consequence-free reign of it. That's not to say that Pit Bonnie's AI is stupid. Pit Bonnie, for the most part, is a consistent threat that has a few aces up his sleeve, even though most of them come from a loaded deck. What I mean by that is that the game does introduce some randomness in his behavior, but they're mostly all predetermined events he will do in relation to the story. This is a blessing or a curse, depending on how you look at it. In games like Alien Isolation, which bears some similarity to Into the Pit in terms of its core game design, the Xenomorph as an apex predator can be a frustration when it comes to its random hunting patterns. Behind the curtain, the Xenomorph's AI is being constantly drip-fed information on occasion, instead of being based on player activity. So sometimes the game can be a bit random and frustrating to get through a section of when it can all come down to how the cards drew themselves that time. Pit Bonnie, on the other hand, operates on a sound-based system. While he follows a set of patrol paths, his behavior is also influenced by the noises you make. You run, he'll investigate. You interact with objects, he will hear you, but only if you're in adjacent rooms. This grants players some control over managing their interactions with Pit Bonnie, allowing them to exert a degree of influence over the monster. While this may seem counterintuitive in a horror game, where typically the monster's actions are more opaque and unpredictable, the gradual introduction of other members of the Fazbear Band and the severe consequences of failure do make up for it. In this context, it becomes less of a downside and more of a strategic element to navigate. Speaking of which, each night in Into the Pit introduces a new member of the Fazbear Band to join Pit Bonnie in his pursuit of Oswald while you're in the pizzeria's past. Here's a brief overview without giving too much away of their mechanics. Chica roams the facility similar to Pit Bonnie, but unlike him, she serves as a mobile alert system, making noise that draws Pit Bonnie towards her location. She can also be lured by distractions, although it appears she will only investigate distractions in adjacent rooms rather than those farther away, based on my experience. Bonnie's mechanics is a little more insidious. Once Blue Bonnie is active whenever you enter a room, a split second roll of the dice will occur to determine if he has spawned in it. If he has, he will be concealed in one of the many hiding spots available to Oswald. Should you choose the spot where Bonnie is hiding, he will grab you, forcing you to complete a quicktime event to break free. This struggle also generates considerable noise, attracting Pit Bonnie to your location. Each spot does show a visual difference if Bonnie is hiding there, so it isn't exactly unfair, as it forces you to be a bit more aware of your surroundings if you wish to hide while on the run. Finally, Freddy's mechanics involves him puppy guarding doors. At random intervals while you're in a room, Freddy will open an exit pathway and then block it before moving on. Unlike the Bonnies, which present direct threats, and Chica, who functions as a lookout, Freddy's role is more about hindering your progress and wasting time. In my experience, I haven't encountered a situation where Freddy's appearance coincided with a high-stress moment involving me being on the run from Pit Bonnie, but it does act as a deterrent for players who attempt to play the game on autopilot, reinforcing the need to remain vigilant and aware of your surroundings at all times. Unfortunately, Foxy does not make an appearance in the game, which is surprising given that Golden Freddy does, appearing as a hiding spot. While Foxy's stage is visible in the pizzeria, and even mentioned by patrons, it's disappointing that the Red Baron of the Seven Seas isn't among the game's many threats. However, Foxy does feature in the hallucination mechanic, making a welcome return from the original Five Nights at Freddy's. During chases or high-stress situations, Oswald can be occasionally confronted with hallucinations of animatronics that briefly fill his screen and startle him. The artwork for these hallucinations is exceptional, and I must admit, they managed to unsettle me on several occasions. All in all, with Pit Bonnie's simplistic hunting tactics being aided by the Fazbear Band's more random elements, the game was a lot more focused on improvising on the fly and planning out your movements accordingly, while some mechanics, such as the security cameras introduced later in the game, may feel less impactful, especially since the security office itself lacks a hiding spot, so it's pretty much a dead end. Literally, they do contribute to the game's overall strategy, given the game's brevity and the opportunity to leverage these mechanics more effectively in subsequent playthroughs. It adds an extra layer of depth and replayability, which the game incentivizes. Into the Pit is not a lengthy experience. I completed it in under 5 hours. However, it is crafted with replayability in mind, encouraging players to refine their techniques, uncover additional secrets, and tackle harder difficulties to master its mechanics. I anticipate that with each subsequent playthrough, I'll be able to shave off significant time, perhaps even beating the game in under an hour if I perfect my approach. With that in mind, it's somewhat surprising the game lacks a scoring system, especially considering its original intent was to emulate classic NES games. Scott Cawthon himself even mentioned that it was initially envisioned for a cartridge release, which further aligns with the game's retro-inspired design and challenge-based replayability. That said, one of my more significant complaints about the game is the lack of late-game challenges. Beyond replaying the game on a harder difficulty, there isn't much in the way of a final boss or grand finale of skill. Achieving the best endings primarily depend on exploring the pizzeria in the past, rather than testing or expanding upon the mechanics themselves and what you've learned from them. I think a large part of this issue comes from there only being 2 locations where Oswald is in danger, his house and the pizzeria in the past. Oswald's house provides a solid early challenge, helping players learn about how Pit Bonnie's behaviors work and how to tackle the game's problem-solving puzzles. However, once you're familiar with the pizzeria, the challenge quickly diminishes over time. You end up memorizing every hiding spot and escape route to perfection, which reduces the game's overall difficulty. A huge missed opportunity in Into the Pit is the lack of an in-game section, perhaps even set at that rundown mill that the game frequently mentions. While the mill is more tied to the backstory of the town, incorporating it into the final act could have provided an exciting and challenging climax. It would have been tense and thrilling to face off against Pit Barney and the rest of the Fazbear Band in a new environment, testing your wits and knowledge of the game with a fresh setting. This could have added a fresh layer of complexity and made the final stretch of the game feel a bit more dynamic and grandiose. After all, the essence of a game like Into the Pit is mastering its mechanics and beating it in the most efficient way possible, and Megacat Studios has done a remarkable job achieving this while preserving the classic horror feelings of Five Nights at Freddy's. I only have the smallest of complaints. The game overall offers a captivating story with memorable characters and a palpable mystery that keeps you invested while keeping you on your edge with the tensity and the fear that it evokes. It's everything I've ever wanted in a modern FNAF game with a new style. For Megacat Studios' first outing, Into the Pit is a tremendous achievement that showcases their love and passion for the series. It elevates the entire FNAF brand, expands the lore, and delivers a fresh experience that I will enjoy playing and dissecting for years to come. See, Steel Wool, it wasn't that hard. I'm not going to be able to hold back. Huh. Into the Night will be right back after these messages.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, let's address the ball pit in the room. Yes, I have listened to that Scott Cawthon 2.0 interview from Daco. And yes, I did, unfortunately, fist pump in the air with vindication for a lot of my theories on what had been occurring behind the scenes with the development of both Secure Breach and The Mimic. Yes, I am the most humble being on this planet. Thank you for noticing. For those who have not listened to the entire interview, it appears that my previous deductions were accurate. A significant issue in the development of Security Breach's narrative was the apparent lack of clarity from Scott Cawthon regarding his intentions for specific elements of the game, and not really divulging to Steel Wool what the narrative and the story of Security Breach should be, which basically put Steel Wool in the awkward position of an absence of direction, with basically them being left on their own to construct a cohesive story based on the incomplete or ambiguous notes provided by Scott Cawthon.
I had a specific story for this in mind, okay, for Security Breach. I really did. I had a very specific story in mind, and it is very different than the one that got in the game. And I think a part of that is the way that I conveyed that to Steel Wool, because what I was trying to do was I was trying to tell Steel Wool to do specific things throughout the game, put specific items in specific places, have specific characters do certain things, meanwhile not telling them what the story plot was. That didn't work out very well because they got all of these pieces and they thought it was their job to connect them in a way that made sense.
However, it would be misguided to absolve Steel Wool Studios of responsibility in totality. They bear a significant portion of the blame for the overall decline in quality seen in the recent FNAF games. The lockdowns and the accompanying challenges thereof, while difficult, would unlikely have altered the fundamental issues that plague Security Breach's release, regardless of how appealing it might be to imagine that the trials of that year could be wholly discarded. The reality remains the same. Even if Security Breach had been free of technical glitches, it would still have been perceived as a lackluster walking simulator. This shortcoming is not attributable to Scott Cawthon's decisions, but rather to a deficiency in imagination and creative vision among the project managers at Steel Wool Studios, who failed to elevate the FNAF series to a more ambitious standard. Nevertheless, it remains puzzling why Steel Wool Studios felt empowered to take such liberties with Scott Cawthon's narrative directions, I mean, the transformation of Burntrap from a mere Easter egg hidden within Freddy Fazbear's Pizza Place to a central final boss is a striking example of how dramatically a creative vision can be derailed.
And I'm hesitant to say this because I don't like messing with the lore. But I think in this case, it's okay. When it comes to Burntrap, originally, Burntrap was never supposed to move. He was supposed to just be something you saw in the corners, or like if you were walking past machinery, you might be able to peek in between two things and see him in the corner or propped up against a wall. Well, obviously, that's not what we got in Security Breach. In Security Breach, we got a capsule opening and purple smoke blowing out and him climbing out and coming to get you.
And this misstep elucidates, as we have both discussed in depth and humorously in Shadow Scrying, why the integration of the Mimic as both Burntrap and Glitztrap seems like a retcon. It essentially is. It now appears that this alteration was less a response to fan feedback and more a consequence of Scott being compelled to incorporate an unplanned element into his storyline in a manner that made sense within the existing lore. Now rest assured, I do not intend to dwell solely on the negatives here, nor to continue this episode talking about Steel Wool. Again, as Scott Cawthon himself mentions in the interview, he has become more involved in the development of Ruin, and I suspect his engagement with Help Wanted 2 was similarly substantial. While I acknowledge the ongoing concern regarding the perceived infantilization of FNAF and its impact on its effectiveness as a horror game, I remain hopeful. That trailer for The Secrets of the Mimic and Scott's discussion of both the Fazbear Frights and the Tales novella in his interview suggests that the decision to make the games more child-friendly may have been a choice driven by Steel Wool Studios rather than Scott Cawthon himself. This is pure speculation and unproven. Scott's admission that a significant portion of the novellas are inspired by his own life and imagination, later expanded upon by the writers, has led me to believe the contrast between the dark adult themes of the novels and the more sanitized approach of the games reflects a divergence in vision from a creator and artist compared to a board and committee. Again, this is just speculation and theory, but it is what I'm holding out on for the time being. And I'm not aiming to despair Steel Wool Studios, despite how entertaining it might be to critique their work. Rather, I want to emphasize the commendable achievements of Mega Cat Studios. For many FNAF fans like me, it appears that Mega Cats have truly picked up the torch that we felt FNAF had dropped years ago and led us back to the home and place we both are familiar with and love. I still have high hopes for Steel Wool. Nope, couldn't get through that. I am still cautiously optimistic for Steel Wool's projects. But knowing now that Mega Cat Studios is developing a fetch game and continuing to deliver remarkable experiences over the next several years, oh, that is incredibly exciting. Mega Cat Studios clearly demonstrates a deep, genuine passion for the Finance of Freddy series, evident in the meticulous attention to detail and the numerous nods, Easter eggs, and references that resonate with true fans rather than being driven by a committee or a PR team. The depth and care they've invested in capturing every facet of the series could easily fill an entire episode of this podcast. In fact, just for the fun of it, I'm going to interrupt this entire review and discussion to bring us back to 2014 YouTube and deliver a top 12 list of my favorite Easter eggs and references to the Finance of Freddy's universe in Into the Pit. Why top 12? Because I like to stay two steps ahead. So let's have a little bit of fun and celebrate 10 years of Five Nights at Freddy's. Go! Number 12. Trash and the Gang at the Mill. This reference is perhaps one of the most straightforward that Mega Cat Studios could have included, yet it's highly appreciated. In Freddy Fazbear's Pizzeria Simulator, there was a wealth of whimsical joke animatronics and characters that Michael Lafton could purchase for his pizzeria. None were more overt than the Trash and the Gang collection, which humorously depicts Michael engaging what seems like dumpster diving at the outset, and subsequently acquiring what are essentially trash items marked with Sharpied on faces as entertainment mascots for his restaurant. All the members of this gang are represented, and according to Oswald, they've been part of the mill ever since it ceased operations. Thus, it seems we have a plausible explanation for where Michael acquired these, let's call it rustic, characters. Number 11. The myriad posters throughout the years. While this might seem like a little bit of a cop-out, the sheer volume of poster references in the game is substantial enough to warrant its own top 10 list. Notably, the Fredbear posters that Gregory encounters in Security Breach are particularly significant, as the children's drawings on the walls mirror those of FNAF 3 as well. Additionally, the neon signs in the arcade are a nod to Rockstar Row in Security Breach. There's even a torn one of Bonnie's face that references Wither Bonnie in Jeff's Pizzeria. Number 10. The mini arenas in the security office. When Oswald accesses the security room finally, players will notice a group of minarinas from sister location clinging to and crawling across the various monitors. While the presence of the minarinas is a direct nod to sister location itself, it's also a subtle reference to the Fazbear Fright story, Room for One More, given their context in the security room. Intriguingly, when Oswald uses the cameras and, to avoid spoilers, experiences a loss of control over the monitors, the error message displayed reads, CAM_1280. This is a direct reference to another Fazbear Fright story, The Man in Room 1280. Number 9. Michael Afton's Foxy Mask. One of my personal favorite Easter eggs in the game, though regrettably revealed in the trailer, is the Foxy Mask found at the prize dispenser in the arcade cabinet. This mask isn't just a general Foxy reference, but holds particular significance as it alludes to Michael Afton. Although it may not be Michael's mask per se, the fact that a basket of exotic butters is right next to it further ties it to the hero of Freddy Fazbear Pizzeria Simulator. It's nice to see a tribute to Michael's character, even if Scott may have forgotten about our beloved hero. Well, unless Glam Mike turns out to be true. Number 8. Bounce Pot from FNAF World. On that same token, on the shelf just below the prize counter housing Michael's mask, players can spot a sprite version of Bounce Pot from Scott Cawthon's least favorite project, FNAF World. Notably, with the exception of Old Man Consequences, who has come about his own through Ultimate Custonite, Bounce Pot stands as the third most referenced character for FNAF World following Lolbit. Number 7. GGY on the arcade machines. One of the more contentious Easter eggs in the game is found during the first night when Oswald travels back in time. If he examines the arcade cabinets, he will notice the top initials on the high score leaderboards of almost all the arcade cabinets are GGY. For those familiar with the Into the Night podcast or who have read the Tales of the Pizzaplex novellas, this is a direct reference to Gregory, as featured in the novella GGY. No, Gregory did not travel back in time. Meg Katz was smart enough to have some NPC claim to be the one responsible for the high scores in the game itself. Number 6. Garrett's Red Plane. Who says all the references have to relate to previous FNAF games or books? Inside Oswald's house, players can discover a red plane, which is likely a nod to Garrett, Michael Schmidt's brother in the Finance of Freddy's movie. Ugh, so hyped for the second movie now that we got confirmation that Toy Robots will be present. Although Mangle, I just know will be a nightmare for them to make. Number 5. Bonnie's Guitar. Continuing with the theme of movie references, Bonnie's Guitar contains two allusions, one rather obvious and another that runs a little bit deeper. When Oswald acquires a notebook from a Fazbear technician, the notes regarding Bonnie's guitar indicate that a child was electrocuted after touching it. This serves as a subtle nod to the movie, where Abby is similarly struck by a jolt of electricity when she interacts with the guitar, but additionally, the technician notes that this particular guitar is the second model. This is a clever allusion to the legal challenges Scott had faced concerning Bonnie's guitar design being copyrighted. As a result, Bonnie's guitar has been different in all subsequent iterations. Clever reference, Megacats. Number 4. Chica Eating Garbage. The betrayal of Chica as a voracious eater, a headcanon that has become somewhat official over time, reached a new extreme in Security Breach, where Glamrock Chica is depicted consuming garbage. Into the Pit carries this concept forward, amplifying it by depicting Chica not only eating garbage, but also constructing burrows of refuse in which she can indulge her appetite for trash to her heart's content. Number 3. Buff Helpy. While not a reference to the broader FNAF universe per se, this Easter egg is a nod to one of Scott Cawthon's favorite YouTubers, Docco. For several months, Docco was humorously plagued by his fans who continually spammed a meme featuring a muscular half-naked man with Helpy's head photoshopped onto it. In a playful gesture, either Scott or Meerkat Studios decide to incorporate this meme into the game, making a buff version of Helpy an actual, playable arcade game that Oswald can engage with. Number 2. Phone Guys Return. I can already hear the groans. Many anticipated this would take the number 1 spot. Occasionally, while Oswald travels to the past, he can answer a ringing phone and hear Phone Guy's voice on the other end. This surprise is indeed a delightful callback, but it loses a bit of its impact because it's voiced by someone other than Scott Cawthon. The fact that the iconic character isn't portrayed by Scott himself means it doesn't quite earn the top position. That distinction is reserved for Number 1. The photograph of William and Henry in the past. Towards the end of the game, Oswald can discover a black and white photograph that momentarily distracts Pit Bonnie. This image, upon closer inspection, appears to depict William and Henry with their faces erased. Given the uncertain future of the FNAF series, it's a significant and eerie nod to the origins of the lore. It's particularly unsettling to see that Pit Bonnie, despite being an possible agony manifestation of William's malevolence, still harbors a trace of attachment to the man he betrayed and the memories of his former life. And by fondness, I naturally mean it triggered frustration and unmitigated anger, rage, jealousy, and murderous impulses. Ah, good old Billy Afton. Into the Night will be right back after these messages. Before we get into any form of theory crafting, let's talk about the one major conundrum that still went unanswered from this game. Just a brief warning, there will be no more spoiler filter from here on out. So if you wish to enjoy the End of the Pit blind, be sure to check out another episode of End of the Night instead. Ready? Okay. The big debate that still remains right now is whether or not the game is in fact canon to the series. Now, let's not pretend for a minute that we don't know what this means. When I say canon, I mean explicitly. Did these events occur in the same universe in which William Afton got springlocked, Michael Afton was scooped, and Gregory, Cassie, and the Mimic, and everything that makes up the canon world of FNAF? Well, Tales, for the most part, has always been consistent with its canonicity, and the presence of a Mimic game is making the argument against the Tales game theory even weaker. The truth of the matter is Fazbear Frights has always been the reason why the literature side of the franchise has been dubious as it pertains to the continuity of the series. Not only does it contradict aspects of the core series, it even fails to maintain a consistent world and time period across its own book series. Now we have a game, based on the book, based off the games. Where does that leave us? Is it canon? Well, if you want my opinion, there's no reason for it not to be. Given that End of the Pit specifically is effectively a retelling of events, and that DJ Sturf, a fellow FNAF content creator, has admitted on his streams that not only did he beta test the game, but Megacats could not implement some of his Easter egg recommendations because they had to maintain some continuity elements. Well, because of that, it seems to me that Scott is attempting to rectify his mistake with Fazbear Frights by making Frights canon by virtue of readjusting them to fit better into place with his more expansive canon FNAF world. What do I mean by that? Well, that's where we have to get into theory territory, because in all honest truth, the story of End of the Pit is straightforward. The only missing detail would be the origin of Pit Bonnie, as it isn't a robot nor a man, but some form of being of agony, a demon that manifested itself and found a method of escaping to our reality. End of the Pit as a story is so secluded, though, from the rest of the events surrounding the canon FNAF timeline that there isn't really anything to talk about as it relates to how the story affects the major plot, as it's more so the major plot that has set the pieces in motion for this minor one. But as it pertains to the rest of the Fazbear Frights series, this is where things get interesting. Throughout the game, 3 distinct minigames can be discovered, each serving as a dark mirror to the death minigames from FNAF 2, an elegant nod to the series' continuity. Most intriguingly, These minigames appear to be symbolic representations of the narratives of three specific entries in the Fazbear Fright anthology: To Be Beautiful, Count the Ways, and Fetch. At first glance, these minigames seem to function as mere homages, employing FNAF's iconic 8-bit art style to symbolically reenact their respective stories. However, a closer examination reveals subtle yet significant deviations from the original source material, suggesting deeper, perhaps more insidious, connections. Among the three, the minigame that has garnered the most attention is based on Count the Ways, yes, my personal favorite from the Fazbear Fright series and arguably one of the most compelling novellas in the entire FNAF franchise. This minigame reimagines the Foxy Go 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 minigame from FNAF 2, with Millie Fitzsimmons navigating from one room to another, each room containing one of five objects, culminating in a celebration upon collecting them all. For those unfamiliar with the novella, the significance of these items may initially appear cryptic, a critique I share, and it's one I've levied at Security Breach a lot. Though in this instance, given the game's direct lineage from a book series, such ambiguity feels more justifiable than in the Steel:Wool era. Astute readers will recognize that each item Millie collects symbolizes one of the death methods proposed by Funtime Freddy: water for your dehydration, cupcakes for starvation, snowflakes for freezing, a pierced heart for impalement, and a cauldron for boiling. I hardly need to remind you how the story concludes, correct? I've extolled its virtues countless times, and the broader FNAF community is intimately familiar with it. There's a reason why Count the Way videos and fan songs surpass any other Fazbear Fright media in popularity. Hell, even this very podcast, the Count the Ways episode, is still one of the most popular. We all know the iconic ending where Millie Fitzsimmons faces the harrowing choice of decapitation, with the story's conclusion deliberately leaving us in suspense. Did Millie narrowly escape? Or did Freddy ultimately succeed in taking her life? However, that's not how the minigame concludes. Contrary to one might expect, the minigame does not culminate in Millie collecting five symbols associated with a guillotine or any imagery suggesting decapitation. Instead, the game takes an unexpected turn. Millie discovers a single object in the center of the room, and rather than a sharp instrument, it's something far more unsettling. Funtime Freddy's right hand, with his faithful accomplice, Bon Bon, perched atop it. I won't deny, when I first encountered this minigame, the implications left me stunned. I held off on forming any concrete conclusions or theories until I completed the game a second time, securing the coveted 3-star true ending. Yet even then, I was left grappling with the same conflicting interpretations that this particular minigame seemed to evoke. While Count the Ways leaves Millie's fate shrouded in ambiguity, I am certain that her story is later clarified in the Stitch Ray Stingers. There, we learn that Millie's fate was sealed. Her soul became one of many lost, trapped within the bull pit's dark echoes, forever wandering the flip side in a futile search for the peace that eluded her in life. One of the primary reasons why the Fazbear Fright series has sparked debate over its canonicity, and why some, myself included, have expressed criticism regarding the management of these books, lies in the perception that Scott Cawthon was using them as a testing ground for various concepts. It often seemed as though these stories existed within an ambiguous, ethereal pocket dimension, neither fully kin to the game series nor entirely separate from it. This allowed for the possibility of selectively integrating certain narratives or elements into the official canon, contingent on fan reception, without having to endure consequence if one turned out to be a dud. In a sense, we're arriving at precisely what I had anticipated, albeit in an unexpected way. Because if we take this minigame at face value, it seems to suggest that Millie Fitzsimmons didn't merely perish at the hands of Funtime Freddy, but was transformed into his accomplice, Bon Bon. This implication is undeniably dark, yet it also serves to anchor Count the Ways within a more specific context, in the canon of FNAF timeline. If Into the Pit, the game, is indeed canon, and by extension, this minigame legitimizes Count the Ways as part of the official lore, it might offer an explanation for Funtime's Freddy's appearance in the story in the conspicuous absence of Bon Bon as part of him. Many fan interpretations of the story depict Funtime Freddy as missing his right hand entirely, an in-universe explanation for why this iconic element of the character has gone missing. But what if the opposite is true? What if Bon Bon's creation was instead a psychological safeguard, a mechanism designed to keep Funtime Freddy under control after his previous escape from Afton Robotics? Circus Baby does reveal in Sister Location that the Funtimes, including herself, have managed to escape before, though she never delves into specifics beyond the fact that they were always recaptured.
I've been out before, but they always put me back. They always put us back inside.
Interestingly, Funtime Freddy in Count the Ways is depicted with striking similarity to his beta design, as seen in Sister Location's extra mode, notably lacking the presence of Bon Bon and having a more pink color palette. This omission raises an intriguing question about the story's place in the timeline and the implications of his design in relation to the broader FNAF lore. We've already seen through Into the Pit how Megacats has not only altered the original storyline for gameplay purposes, such as by enabling the player to save a sudden influx of captured children by the hands of Pit Bonnie, but has also expanded the narrative world itself. Characters like Jeff and Gabrielle are given greater depth or increased significance compared to the original depictions, and the ball pit has even been completely changed from an agony-infested mosh pit, where simply dark echoes of the past allowed Oswald to transfer himself to a memory, into specifically something that affects the timeline, where Oswald is going into the past and the events that happened there, like putting up a paper pal or pit pointing destroying doors, then echoes into the present. What if, for the stories Scott deems incompatible with Megacat's vision for Frights games, he opts to reimagine them as these 8-bit minigames, with these retellings recontextualizing the stories, making them accessible to not just a new audience, but integrating them into the FNAF world. The canon FNAF world. This theory could also shed light on why Fetch was given a minigame that deviates from a straightforward retelling. Unlike To Be Beautiful and Count the Ways, Fetch is the next project on Megacat's slate, as confirmed by Scott, and the true ending of Into the Pit strongly hints that Fetch is on the horizon. If Fetch is said to be a reimagined narrative for a full game, altering its story within an 8-bit minigame would seem redundant, not to mention messy if they end up having to change large portions of the narrative. I mean, the original conclusion for Fetch wasn't a happy ending like the one in Into the Pit, so if they wanted to have that, they would have to, therefore, change the entire story. What if the Fetch minigame is subtly hinting at a narrative element that has yet to be revealed, foreshadowing details that the upcoming game will elaborate on, serving more so as a teaser for what is to come, rather than a reflection of what has already transpired? This becomes particularly intriguing when considering what the Fetch minigame suggests, and this is where I'm going to lose some people. The Fetch minigame, in my opinion, showcases a clear divergence from the established narrative of Frights. Specifically, it implies that this version of events will not align one-to-one with the games, like Into the Pit and, on a broader and controversial note, the widely debated theory that Andrew is a prime candidate for the role of Golden Freddy and the one he should not have killed. In the minigame, the initial screen prominently features a Golden Freddy sprite with distinctive pinprick white eyes. Additionally, the game culminates with Fetch attacking the player character, whose sprite could plausibly represent Andrew, especially since Fetch is depicted in a newly designed form, rather than the disfigured dissolved state described in the novella, so there is a far chance it is supposed to represent the novella's character, Greg. These specific modifications suggest a deliberate recontextualization of elements to align with the continuity of the game canon, rather than the Fright's book canon. This pattern may also extend to Be Beautiful. It is well known that Eleanor emerges as a significant antagonist in the Stitch Race Stingers, ultimately becoming the primary antagonist of the entire Fazbear Fright series. However, the minigame of To Be Beautiful introduces notable deviations. While it ostensibly replicates the events of the story, showing Eleanor granting Sarah's wishes to be attractive, desired, and beautiful, it subtly alters key details. Observant viewers will note that a crucial element of the story has been reversed. In the original narrative, Eleanor granted Sarah's wish on the condition that she wore a pendant to conceal her transformation. In the minigame, however, Eleanor provides that same pendant only after fulfilling Sarah's wishes, and intriguingly, that pendant is no longer heart-shaped. That is important. The heart-shaped pendant is a pivotal MacGuffin in the Stitch Race Stingers. For God's sakes, it's a massive deal in the entire FNAF universe. The first ever physical artifact composed entirely of remnant. However, in the minigame, this detail undergoes a significant alteration. The pendant is presented as being given to Sarah only at the conclusion rather than the very beginning of the story. And when she acquires it, she's only then transformed into a heap of scrap metal. Furthermore, Eleanor does not assume Sarah's place at the end of the story, as one might expect based on the original storyline in the novella. I may be going too deep down the rabbit hole here, I admit, but I believe these alterations imply that Eleanor might play a less significant role in this new game iteration of events compared to her prominence in Fazbear Fright. With Andrew's storyline remaining uncertain until Fetch is released to clarify the gaps, and with both Count the Ways and Into the Pit showing substantial changes from their original narratives, particularly the latter, which carefully incorporates Easter eggs to avoid contradicting existing lore and remains consistent within the timeline, could it be that this new version of events in the Fright series is resetting the narrative framework for the Fright's books as a whole? We do see that the Stitch Wraith is amongst us, with a hidden sprite Easter egg that Megacats even bothered to animate, suggesting that the inclusion is more than just a for-the-fans nod akin to Garen's plane or the Foxy Mask. Additionally, Scott Cawthon has acknowledged that some stories, such as In the Flesh and Fazgu, did not resonate as well as with fans, and he isn't exactly pleased with them himself. This raises the possibility that Scott is not merely remastering his narratives, but also undertaking a broader effort to refine and purge elements that did not succeed, effectively cleaning the house of the string he could not weave into gold. Regardless of the outcome, I am eagerly anticipating what comes next from Megacats and the direction they will take us. I'm fully committed to the journey at this point. I'm all in. Although I am still adamant that a direct statement from Scott about his intentions and the canonicity of the Fazbear Fright books would have been a more advantageous solution, this approach might be the more pragmatic middle ground we could achieve. And personally, I'm just looking forward to the next year, or the year after, to go play Fetch. And with all that said, this ends tonight's program of Into the Night. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to stay updated, please consider subscribing, following, or sharing this podcast. It truly helps us broaden our reach. Consider following us on our Twitter at Fazbear Podcast, joining our Discord, or supporting us on our Patreon or merch store using the various links in the description of this episode. As always, I have been your host, Nick. And I would like to thank you all once again for listening. Have a good night, and drive home safe.
need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.